because, like, I made a thing and it blows up, but, you know, I'm extremely tough and also I regenerate.
Right.
Why didn't you just regenerate?
What do you mean that our ramshackle vehicles with no absorbers are breaking your spine?
Do you only have one?
Right. Live from the Mundangerous WOG in New York City, I'm your host Shane.
And I'm your host Ishan.
And welcome to episode 286 of Total Party Thrill, a podcast for game masters and players where we discuss our campaigns in order to inspire yours.
In this episode, we're talking about using orcs in your game, boyos.
Yours using orcs in our game.
Yeah. But first, the party becomes reluctant petitioners in the Gates of Morning campaign. And later, the all-nighter never tires out in the Character Creation Forge.
So real quick, just a thank you to everybody who came and joined our Gen Con online panel. We are technically recording before the panel has happened, so if there were a lot of you, awesome, and if there weren't, thanks for those loyal few who joined.
We are coming to you from the past, so we will assume that it went fine and anything that went wrong was our fault.
Yeah, if it was great, then, you know, hey, good for us, and if it was horrible, well, sorry, it only cost you an hour. You could have logged off any time, and you didn't, and for that, we appreciate you.
At least it was free. And now we all have a story.
Right. The time you wasted $0.
I can't believe what you said, though, Shane.
I can't either.
On the mic. That was highly inappropriate.
It was either inappropriate or very intelligent. There's really only two ways that could go.
It could have been both.
I mean, ideally.
Both insightful, and yet no one's supposed to say that out loud.
And yet off-putting. Why are you mad at me? I'm right.
You can't say that in podcasting. Well, anyway, I'm glad we were brave enough to do it.
All right, so where are we in the Gates of Morning campaign?
The Gates of Morning campaign is our 5th edition D&D game set in Eberron, a sequel of sorts to the original Morning Glory campaign. And in Flamekeep, the seat of the Church of the Silver Flame, the party is hunting down a rogue sect of House Jurasco. The city is a fortress, with a deep moat dug into the cliff face that connects to Sion Sound. As their boat nears the shore, the party can see the streets are packed with people. The captain swears, because he has just realized that their delay has put them in Flamekeep on Ascension Day, the holiest day of the year for the church, commemorating the binding of a fiendish overlord by Tira Moran and the birth of the flame itself 699 years ago.
So all of the pilgrims and the devout gathered en masse in both celebration and contemplation. Some of them are praying quietly, others are praying loudly, some even mortify their flesh in public.
As Vesicott steps ashore, the Kalashtar feels a subtle but familiar buzzing inside his head, and concentrating, he realizes he's only felt this sensation in the presence of the Mind Seeds, Pol and Elaine. And so he guesses that another one of the former refugees must be nearby, although he is unable to pinpoint an exact location.
So a skeptical-looking human in fine robes greets the party at the docks and introduces himself as Zodar D'Orion, who will take them the rest of the way to Fairhaven in Ondair via an Orion trade caravan. But because of the holiday, he says they may stay the night in the Orion Enclave here in Flamekeep, and they'll leave the next day. What could go wrong?
Absolutely nothing. So the group makes their way very slowly through the crowds, trudging upward towards the central part of the city.
The crowds stall at the crest of a hill that looks down a long road. Around the corner in the distance, a caravan emerges. There are knights, followed by soldiers with pikes, and then clerics in robes. And finally behind them, an open-topped carriage, in which is seated a small, lone figure. Vesicott and Switch realize this is Jayla Darren, the 11-year-old Keeper of the Flame, greeting the faithful with a rare in-person appearance for the High Holiday.
We get to see the Lollipop Mobile.
As the caravan turns the corner and into sight, the buzzing in Vesicott's head grows louder.
Oh. So the crowd surges forward as the keeper's carriage approaches, and you know, everyone wants to be able to gaze upon her. Switch pushes Vesicott into a column of pilgrims being ushered by soldiers to the keeper's side. The Kalishar clasps hands with the tiny girl. For a moment, she seems confused by his presence and then gives him a warm smile and says, "I see you," before turning to the next petitioner.
Not more than a minute later, with the party just behind the carriage, a commotion breaks out near the keeper. A peasant begins screaming in an alien tongue. Using her helmet of languages, Switch can tell he is shouting, "Death to the usurper." He raises a clenched hand, and Warden and Lenore can briefly spot a dark crystal with black veins running through it, held in his palm. A nearby knight chops the man's hand off, and as the fist drops to the ground, it explodes.
The earth shakes as a massive explosion rips through the crowd, vaporizing pilgrims and knights alike, and throwing those further away into buildings where they collapse into crumpled heaps. A translucent dome is now visible over the carriage, and the keeper appears unharmed, as is the party, which was shielded by the carriage. Hey, good place to take cover.
But at the epicenter of the explosion, bathed in flames, stands a 7-foot-tall demon, a taloned monstrosity with tattered wings and the head of a vulture.
And we'll find out what happens next week.
So this week, we are continuing our series on using iconic monsters in your game, both as a GM and a player. And of course, this week, we are talking about orcs, ORCS, ORKS, yeah, all of the above. Mindless, murderous hordes have always been the stuff of a nightmarish lore. The root of orc, in fact, originally meant an evil spirit of some kind, and it is etymologically related to words like ogre or orcus.
Does the word orc predate Tolkien?
It does, it does. He actually took it from Beowulf.
I didn't read Middle English, but I guess he did.
oh yeah, it's pretty much all he did. Well, so the modern conception of the orc does come originally from Tolkien. He used the word to mean the evil, corrupted creatures of Mordor, who are bent wholly on cruelty and destruction. Of course, this means that like many iconic monsters, and like a lot of lore that came out of Tolkien, their origin is steeped in racism.
I can hear the discourse firing up on Twitter already, Ishan.
Oh, yeah. I mean, Tolkien himself said that he imagined them as a kind of caricature of Mongols. Hunchbacked, flat noses, angular eyes. And in his stories, he used them as cannon fodder. So, you know, they were creatures that good people could kill without compunction.
And that is the role they played in D&D up until very recently.
And still sometimes.
And yeah, at a lot of tables, still sometimes. There wasn't much difference between orcs, goblins, and other creatures who were, you know, monsters worthy of extermination.
Yeah, I mean, there's the traditional, like, you know, moral test for the paladin, which is like, do you kill the orc babies? And if you don't kill the orc babies, you fall.
Yes, the old Gary Gygax trick.
You know, you would have like a rare, intelligent, compassionate, or strategic orc that could be parlayed with, but this is really more like a plot point, right? Think of like Obold Many Arrows, who is a Drizzt foe, who has a kind of like problematic name. You know, we'll get into more of that.
Yeah, wow, that's a... okay.
Yep.
That is derivative.
But other settings and systems have taken the orc into dozens of different permutations. I mean, Warcraft orcs are what they have shamanistic traditions, although that's just like a noble savage trope. Yay.
Warhammer orcs with a K aren't mammals or animals. They're psychic fungus, kind of.
Yeah, warlike. Yeah, seems to be.
Barbaric. And, you know, they are caricatures of soccer hooligans. So, you know.
And also, like, played for comedic effect / body horror.
Uh-huh, yeah.
So when you're using orcs in your game, it is important to establish whether you're using mindless orcs or sapient orcs. Do they have a choice in how they act? Tolkien orcs didn't. So, you know, to a one, they are evil. Problems are going to arise if you treat one kind of orc as the other kind of orc, especially when you treat your sapient orcs like your mindless hordes.
right? Although there are good stories that can be told about PCs or characters overcoming their own prejudices and stereotypes and, you know, being confused about one type of orc over another. In every incarnation of orcs, though, for the most part, orcs are portrayed as living fully. Whether they are loud or pious or bloodthirsty or passionate or creative, their emotions are amplified. They're larger than life. Rather than making them one-dimensional, though, this can be a really good opportunity for other characters to maybe wonder why their own lives are so small in comparison.
Yeah, to be an orc is to be one among many, many, many in the horde. Even a solitary orc would be alone because they sought to get away. It means that an individual orc must strive to be noticed, to stand out, especially if other races see them as a, you know, part of that interchangeable horde, not as an individual.
Yeah, we'll get into this, but your portrayal of orcs then becomes multi-layered because you have, you know, how orcs actually are, then how they are portrayed or seen by others, and then the orcish reaction to that. And you can play storylines at any of those levels. Orcs, I think, when used like allegorically, their place in the story is usually to reflect the best and worst parts of people, which I think is partly why they invoke such strong emotions in players. So many people either absolutely love orcs and everything they represent, and or absolutely hate orcs, don't want to see them at all, don't want to be at a table with them.
The important first step when using orcs is to define them. Is this the mindless horde, warlike mass that is descending upon you?
Yeah, in this instance, they're almost more like an environmental phenomena than like a humanoid race, right? Like, so sure, they speak words and they fight with hands and weapons and they kill people, but there really isn't much room for orc life, right? The trappings of living, of, you know, art and relationships or anything like that. Like those don't really sort of exist, right? They're basically fantasy zombies or, you know, Zerg or Tyranids.
Well, sure. I think Tyranids are the more mindless horde, but sure. But I think what's important with this is that you're going to brush aside the reality of biological necessity, right? Like, you're not going to make them realistic. You don't worry about baby orcs and their parents. You don't ask those questions. You don't invite them. You know, orcs are born or created or cursed, and they just are. And now they do because they don't have any other way of being. They make war because they are war incarnate.
Yeah, they're more like demons, or maybe like the 5th edition D&D version of gnolls, which are essentially demonic spirits in physical creature form. And you run into a lot of problems when you take the mindless horde type of orc and try to make like biological sense out of them, because then suddenly you have questions about like, okay, but can a baby orc be, you know, preternaturally evil? And, you know, is it okay to kill these things? And these are questions that Tolkien sort of wrestled with, because he had a lot of throwaway lines, which were like, oh, yeah, and they breed like men. And then suddenly you're like, wait, they breed?
Wait, what?
Okay, well,
yeah, hold on.
Right. If they're evil all the time, then the breeding is not going to be very pleasant. And now suddenly we're dealing with stories that nobody really wants to tell.
This got worse. How did this get worse?
Yep. Mm-hmm. Right. So, you know, if you are going to have orcs who are always evil all the time, give them a reason for that. Make them not be real creatures.
This is in a lot of ways the 40K orc.
Yeah.
A little bit played for comedic effect, right? Because they are the soccer hooligan inspired, right? You have the Gork and Mork thing. But at the end of the day, like, are you cunning yet brutal, or brutal yet cunning? Like, that joke is really just a reflection of they're coming to kill you. That's all they do. They magically make war through their psychic abilities, and that's what they're here for, is to just fight. And if they weren't fighting you, they'd be fighting themselves.
I think the 40k orcs are actually probably one of my favorite representations of orcs, just because it has, like, you know, Games Workshop came up with a pretty interesting explanation for, like, why the heck these things exist and can exist in like an ecosystem that kind of makes some sort of sense. There's never an orc in 40k that's like upset that it's dying or like wishes it could have fulfilled more in life. You know, like, they're not introspective creatures.
For a race that embodies so many negative tropes, there's such joy to 40k orcs. Like, that's what I think is missing from so much of the D&D orc, honestly, is like they're a mindless horde, except when it makes it funny, right? They're mindless except when, like, it gets to reflect on their own ridiculousness of being mindless and warlike and barbaric.
Yeah, I think actually the 40k orcs are a great example of the next type of orc that you can use in your game, which is basically jolly monsters. It's a totally different type of archetype to the mindless horde, right? It's a less serious take that emphasizes the orc's passion, sometimes their ingenuity. You know, often orcs will be tinkerers, or they'll be able to create things with artifice. Like, they're good with machines for some reason, like Donatello, I guess. They make things explode because, like, they like to see splody things.
In the novel Orcs, I don't know if you've ever read that one by Mary something. Orcs become basically marines, and they evolve very rapidly. They learn to use any technology that they get their hands on, and they basically become, oh, it's called grunts. Grunts is the name of it. But yeah, it's that, right? It is, they're here to fight, but they're going to get really, really good at fighting and learning really quickly, because they have all the skills you need to become fast evolving warriors.
Yeah, and in this situation, like, their toughness and their proclivity for violence and or explosions makes them super, super dangerous. They're not necessarily dangerous because they intend to be dangerous, right? The 40k orcs more so, right? Like, they're basically killing machines, but there are iterations of orcs that are, like, lean more heavily into playfulness. And it's not so much that they are trying to kill you, it's just that they don't really understand how fragile you are. Because, like, I made a thing and it blows up, but, you know, I'm extremely tough and also I regenerate.
Right.
Why didn't you just regenerate?
What do you mean that our ramshackle vehicles with no shock absorbers are breaking your spine?
Do you only have one?
Right.
They remind me kind of like, I don't know, maybe green-skinned minions, like capital M, the movie Minions, who seem to have things explode in their face all the time that would, in a realistic setting, kill people easily, no problem, destroy entire cities. But they just sort of bounce back because of toon logic.
Right.
And you can have the kind of jolly orc who is subject to the physics of toon logic, even in a realistic setting. Then the next type of orc is probably maybe the most common one used in fantasy settings, and that is orc as the enemy. So they're humanoid creatures just like any other, but their goals are opposed to those of the PCs or the protagonists or, you know, the starting location, what have you. And their alignment, like whether or not they are evil or, you know, always evil or whatever, matters much less than their motivations for doing the things that they're doing. It's not necessarily about them being good or evil or having evil intent. It's more about people fighting over land or a religion. You know, the orcs, you always paint the orcs as bad when both of you need this pasture land.
They're the other.
Now, in this instance, the orcs need to have a real culture, but it doesn't necessarily need to be one that is pleasant to the PCs or pleasant to the players. It can be different, it can be alien, and that is okay. It should make some internal sense, though. Most depictions of orcs as always evil, and there's always infighting, and there's backstabbing, like those, like, might make right depictions of, like, laissez-faire libertarianism gone wild, would fall apart in any sort of realistic setting in like a week. And it doesn't make sense that orcs can like live perpetually in those societies.
Yeah. I mean, I think where that runs into issues, especially, is like where orcs are also played as incredibly dumb or incredibly crude.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You know, the orc leader is the smart orc, right? Like the, you know, the orc shaman or the orc like war caster is the wise orc, right? And they're really singular in that sense. And everyone else is just, I'm bigger than you, therefore I'm more important than you, right? And it like, I don't know, that becomes just as troublesome though, right? It just is unrealistic.
Yeah, and I think an important thing to remember here is to have the orc as, to take like the enemy slot in a story, so often we are conditioned to think of them as playing either the savage race or the noble savage race. And like, those are the two options, right? But those don't need to be inherently tied to the orc. You know, you can get rid of all that baggage. It doesn't need to be like that. It was invented out of whole cloth a few decades ago. We can uninvent it.
And you can do that by providing an opportunity to see issues from the orc's perspective. Of course, that means that you need to have knowledge of what the orc's perspective is. You need to kind of think through and plan that, right? But you need to understand, like, why did they do the things that they do? You know, if they're fighting over pastoral lands or trying to expand their borders, why, right? And are those motivations that much different from the motivations of the opposing side?
Even if the orcs want to kill farmers that the PCs know, does that make them evil? Or is that something that the PCs and their allies would do in an instant to orc farmers?
Right.
There is also sort of like this potentially interesting tension here where you can have an orc culture be like pretty much any other culture in your setting, just a different one, right? You can also have it be completely alien, not quite maybe to the level of like aberrations and the far realm where like time doesn't necessarily make sense in the same way. But Dan Abnett does this thing in the Gaunt's Ghost novels where you get a sort of a behind the scenes look at what chaos is like day to day. It's like on its head, but it makes sense internally. You can see how a creature with thoughts and emotions that makes decisions about its own life lives in that society and makes those decisions, and that they make sense and they don't necessarily have, you know, extreme moral implications.
You're talking about like Garion, where it's like it's a world that they've captured and they're infiltrating it.
Yeah, and then when they go to rescue the traitor.
Yeah, that's Traitor General.
You get these like, it's almost like an Alice in Wonderland type of society where, you know, you'll have humanoids and like people walking around who used to be like regular guardsmen and they've been turned. But then you'll also have like, I don't know, talking typewriters with spindly legs that walk around and like teeny little wings.
Right. Little like warp abominations that have been like conjured up by chaos sorcerers.
Right. And like, and it doesn't seem weird and they aren't inherently evil just because they don't have humanoid form.
Right.
And I think that is a potential, like Alice in Wonderland, I think actually now that I've said that out loud is a good touchstone, or can be a good touchstone for this, where everything is sort of upside down and weird, but not evil. Maybe if you showed up there for the first time, it feels wrong. But if you spend a little time there, you realize it's just different, except for the Queen of Hearts. She sucks. And then I think maybe the last common way to play orcs would be just like anyone else. So it isn't necessarily that the orcs live in a different place and their culture is completely foreign. They're just integrated.
Right.
You know, but probably a playable race option. Right. The culture of orcs in your particular setting is going to be less important than the choices that an orc PC in the party is going to make, or an orc NPC that they're interacting with. Because by their very nature, they're going to be different from the norm.
Right. And that means that if orcs are integrated into the setting, that their culture is going to be reflective of the broader culture at large of whatever area they're in, mm-hmm. rather than insular to them as orcs.
You put an orc in Sigil, it matters much less that you're an orc. It matters much more that you're from the cage.
Right. Or, I mean, even, you know, if you wanted to play it this way, like an orc in Menzo Baranzan would be likely, you know, like, probably going to be pretty good at either trade or a pretty talented artisan in some regard, right? Because otherwise you don't really make it in Menzo Bronson.
Right, exactly like the Mind Flayer or the Durgar who is in Menzo Bronson.
Right.
We didn't eat your brain for a reason. It's the same reason.
Right. Because it's impolite.
We don't do that here. Why would you think that? So in these situations, you know, the individual orc or orcs as a whole might be misunderstood. The misunderstanding might be a plot point. It might not be a plot point. This will vary a lot more from game to game.
And this is one of those things that is going to be completely determined by the interests of, you know, the person who's playing the orc, and also sort of the interests of the other people at the table, right? And as the GM, like, the GM's capability to kind of tell that story. Obviously, like, there can be a lot of parallels to real world racism and some of those struggles. So you want to be careful that you're exploring those themes in a way that is sensitive to, you know, how that might land for other people.
Yeah, and I think this is a good opportunity to hand over some of the reins of the world building to the player who has the interest in playing the orc, or you know more traditionally the half orc. You know, like, let people determine, you know, where they're from, who their parents are, what their relationship is to their parents and to, you know, their culture. I, for one, have always loved half orcs and half elves because fantasy races are not analogies for real world earth cultures, but the struggle of those characters standing with one foot in each culture is something that I relate to as a multiracial person.
That's interesting because I also like those two. And obviously, like, that's less because I have one foot in two cultures and more just because, like, I kind of have a similar thing, right? Where, like, I have conflicting interests, right? Or things that don't always align. Or I have, like, you know, kind of different groups of people that, like, I affiliate with that, like, don't necessarily cross over, right? And so it's like it's a similar, like, obviously it's not the same, right? But it's a similar kind of, like, exploration in play of, like, where are my loyalties and, like, what's more important to me and, like, am I being pushed or pulled in a direction one way or the other, right?
Yeah, like, finding out where I belong is an interesting task for almost any character. Absolutely.
Right. Am I a jock or a nerd?
Right. My father was a fish and my mother was a bird, and here I am on the land, and what do I do?
Is that the plot of A Fish Named Wanda?
It's the plot of our next actual play.
Okay, great.
Tez meets his mom for the first time.
For the first time? What?
Hello, I love you.
What?
She's a fish.
Oh, okay.
All right, so let's talk a bit about orc physiology.
I think the most common orc trait is that they are tougher than the average humanoid. Mm-hmm. So, of course, that invites the question, how do they handle that toughness? Does that make them careless, or does that make them proud of their, you know, is that what they center their personality or their, like, sense of self around how tough they are? Is that a thing that is only apparent to outsiders? Right? Like, if you're an orc who routinely shrugs off, you know, flesh wounds, do you notice? Right? Like, does that really define you in any way to yourself? That's just how you are, right? That's how everyone you know is.
Right. I think about, you know, the perception that an orc is careless, maybe because they're tough, maybe because you don't think they're that bright or whatever, could actually just be extremely logical from the orc's perspective, right? Like, if you know a chef, they got usually thick calluses on their hands because they've been working with hot pans for years. So, you know, they'll just reach into the pan and flip something over without a spatula. They'll just use their fingers. Is that careless? No, they have thick calluses on their hands. They're not getting burnt. Also, they know what they're doing.
Ramshackle vehicles with spotty armor. Not important. The bullets don't hurt.
Right.
I don't care about your flashlight, silly guardsman.
So when you're thinking about the physiology of an orc, you can begin with what is different, what makes them different from a human. And this isn't because you're trying to define how they're different from humans in your setting. I mean, all of us who are playing games are human and we inhabit human bodies. And so in order to think about how you might exist in a different body, begin with the one that you currently have.
Right.
So is food intake different, either amounts of food, types of food? You know, do orcs need to be more specific about the things that they eat? Can they eat a much wider variety of things than humans can?
I like the idea that orcs can eat raw, but they choose not to.
Heartier stomach acid, but also a more refined palate, perhaps. I can taste it all.
Right.
Okay, again, I can digest it, but I can also taste it.
Well, it's just, it's too messy, you know? It's like when you cook it, you get rid of some of that extra juice.
I love the green shine of my skin. Why would I get it dirty? How tough is their skin, actually? Is it the skin or is it the bones or the muscle underneath? Like, how is it that they're so tough? What is it actually about them? Same goes with their strength. Usually orcs are stronger as well. Is it because they're made of mushrooms and they just grow back?
Yeah. A lot of times orcs are also taller or like slightly different proportion so that something that's designed or made for an orc might not like comfortably fit someone of more human proportion.
And vice versa, if you've got an orc stuck in, you know, traditional between 5.5 and 6.5 foot humanoid society.
Right.
Think about biologically. Are they biologically humanoid or are they something else? You know, we keep talking about fungus orcs. They could be something else entirely, a genetic experiment by a wizard, which is the direction that the Tolkien, the like Lord of the Rings movies went. Although then they also did the breeding with people and like now we're yet again in weird Tolkien unpleasant territory.
I like to think that orcs are a gift of Grumsh, and by making war, Grumsh rewards them with more warriors.
Right, because you do need a reason how orcs are able to multiply so quickly. Is that because they breed like rabbits? You know, in certain scenarios, certain explanations for your orcs, that'll make some sense. But maybe it is just the blessing of Grumsh, and, you know, maybe they pop spontaneously from lakes and rivers.
Yeah, and keeping in mind that orcs are often short-lived, is that because, you know, they are more prone to being in combat by culture? Is that because they're corrupt in their nature, that they are like necessarily short-lived, even if they were peaceful hermits?
Yeah, or is that an assumption that writers make when they create stories about orcs because they assume that orcs exist because they are corrupted and therefore they must, you know, they must then be short-lived?
Mm-hmm.
So many of these tropes, again, that we talk about are not things that you need to saddle your orcs with. You can if you find that interesting. Particularly something like this, right? Like a short lifespan is certainly something that can be an interesting tension, mm-hmm. but it isn't something that has to be attached to the character. And remember that your orcs are not going to exist in a vacuum. So if it turns out that they actually are sentient fungi, are there other similar creatures that are a similar part of that ecosystem, right? Are there orc dogs that also regenerate?
Are you trying to create Gretchen right now?
Yes.
Squigs.
And do they also eat their own dogs, I guess?
I mean, you know, in a pinch, why not?
Are squigs their pets or their children or both?
Squigs are a lower life form than Gretchen. So like within the orc ecology, they are the lowest life form.
Okay. But so...
Well, I can't say lowest. Who freaking
right,
knows
right.
what the lowest...
Well, right, so they sort of ladder up like demons do by eating each other?
Not quite. It's like they're... I don't know the details of this, but you don't go from squig to Gretchen to orc.
Okay.
You are a squig, you are an orc, you are a Gretchen, and like their society is structured around that. But like, yeah, there's no like a single being does not move between them, but they are born or spawned in that way.
I see.
They're cultivated, frankly.
Right.
In that way.
Because they're mushrooms.
And then domesticated, of course.
And then think about which legends about your orcs are going to be true, and which legends do people only think are true? One nice thing about figuring out what is true about any kind of creature in your world is having all of those misinformed people who don't know that and think something completely different, and then you get to explain it to them.
Or take advantage of them.
Right, depending on your characters. All right, so let's talk about how to use orcs as NPCs. The interesting thing about having orcs typically come from large groups, whether it's a mindless horde or not, is that a lone orc is typically out of its element. That means that the party may have rare opportunities that present themselves. Sure, a single orc can probably be easily slaughtered even by relatively low-level parties, but it does give a party a chance to see an orc up close, maybe for the first time ever, and to learn about them.
That was a moment that I enjoyed in our Rogue Trader game. The first time that you met an orc and his accompanying Gretchen. They were not alone.
He had a very fine hat.
He did.
I was like, is this because he's an orc or because he's a pirate? Because I haven't really met a pirate either.
Not yet a pirate. You wouldn't be lying to Captain Ront now, would you?
Think about what has this single orc's interactions with non-orc folk been like? Have there been any? This is the first time. Have they only ever been violent or antagonistic? And how much of a mystery are the PCs? Whether that means how much of a mystery are these individual PCs because this orc doesn't know them, and how does that mean that they respond? Or is it because this orc basically has no interactions with anyone who isn't already an orc?
Then also think about, what does an orc need that the PCs can help with? What can the PCs accomplish that the orc can't? Is it something in their world that is missing, right? In the orc world that just isn't available? I think the trope here is that orcs don't have civilization or they don't have fine craftsmanship. So that's sort of what they seek from outsiders. But that doesn't have to be the case. Orcs want to trade because they want orc art, which is superior and requires more skill to be valued far and wide.
It certainly doesn't even, I want meat and weapons.
Right.
Because we don't know how to make them. What is it that orc society has to offer the PCs? You know, why is it that this might be a fruitful relationship that you're beginning? And there probably should be something here, because otherwise why are you including this interaction in your game?
Right.
The party probably meets orcs early on in their adventures when a small group is going to be a tough challenge. But when they do that, think about, spend the time having your players think about what is that experience like? What is it like to be in the presence of an orc? Are they, gross and smelly and ugly? Are they completely hairless? Or are they really tall and really strong? And like, actually, it turns out that they have really crazy weapons that the smoke is coming out of. And I think I'd actually like to get my hands on some of those.
Orcs are like the special forces, in that they're like so tough, so hardy, so skilled, and in war making that like, if you're a regular soldier in the Breelish army and like, an orc company comes through, it's like, oh man, like I was there that day, I saw them. They're like super warriors.
Also, some of them were controlling the weather and then others were turning into animals and it was crazy.
Right. I wonder what missions they got sent on.
Yeah.
And then I think another thing that a lot of times you learn pretty early is that a single orc isn't really a challenge, but there's never just one. A small group of orcs makes an encounter, a large group makes a battle, a horde of orcs becomes a whole arc.
Yeah, and you can sort of sprinkle this in the story backwards. There is a horde of orcs, right? You learn that at level one. It is, three mountain ranges away. Well, now you're going to meet, an advanced scout party, and then you'll meet a full, battle squad, and then eventually you'll need to figure out a way to handle the horde. But no matter how the fight goes, once, you know, it actually comes to blows, reinforcements are always going to be an option. So the tide could turn at any time for the orcs. There's, I think, almost no scenario within the fiction where it's not going to make sense for suddenly there are more orcs.
Yeah, I think the only place is, like, if you stuck them in a room in a dungeon, right?
And if they're fungi orcs, then they can just make more of themselves.
True.
And now you're just never going to get that dungeon clean.
Also, orcs tend to have some minions. In fantasy, I mean, I think wargs are sort of their, like, iconic Tolkien kind of, you know, mount. But wolves obviously make sense, too, in non-Tolkien fiction.
Sometimes they have goblin lackeys. They'll often have alchemical warfare apparatus or artifice, whether that's, you know, artillery units, you know, run by orcs or their minions. But, you know, it makes perfect sense to have a big contraption on treads, you know, come out from the other side of a mountain. And now you're facing that.
Often they have animals, either, like, you know, normal, whatever animals of the ecosystem that they're from. Alternatively, they could be, like, more on the, like, monstrous animal side, right? Something like maybe like a rock could make sense for orcs to be maybe not minions, but allied with. I think that was a thing in, like, Heroes of Might and Magic.
That I don't actually know.
Turn-based strategy games.
So if you are running orcs in combat, they're a great option for small battles or for a larger group of tough bruisers. And they're a great way to measure party progress. They can fight orcs that are similar to each other at different power levels. So, you know, at low levels, when they're just starting out, it's really hard to take on a small band of four orcs, and it nearly kills them, or perhaps it does kill one or more of them. And then, you know, once you finish your first arc of the game and you encounter those same orc squads and you wipe the floor with them, it really drives home the point how far the characters have progressed.
By the time you're taking on, you know, a group of knobs or the war boss themselves, who knows how strong you are.
So you're going to want to leverage the numbers and the strength and toughness of the orcs to overwhelm the party and to just hit hard immediately. Because small numbers of orcs are not usually a threat, you can pretty easily lure parties into, like, this false sense of security where they think, okay, we got them all, or, oh, they're just orcs. And then, you know, suddenly out comes a strange new weapon that they've never seen before, or, you know, they're riding some sort of tamed beast.
In terms of weaknesses, a lot of times there's sort of a mental weakness or a perception that they're, you know, not as tactically minded or not as observant, not as, like, you know, able to react to new information in a battle, so they can be kind of overwhelmed in that regard. You know, whether or not you introduce that, like, you know, I kind of would probably lean a little bit against that, and maybe lean more towards, like, they use simple tactics because they're tougher, and so they don't need anything more complicated.
Yeah, one thing you can do, I mean, you can invert this and say that, you know, actually orcs are very cunning and strategic, but you can also sort of use the metagame against your players. They might naturally assume that because they're facing orcs, they do not need to be that tactical. What they need to do is, like, hit hard and whittle away hit points.
Right.
And then you present them with orcs who seem to know what they're doing, and that can throw them off.
Right. Orcs are hunters, it turns out. Hunters know all about traps.
You are prey. Also, start praying.
To Grumsh, cut your eye out.
A weakness, though, could be something like a misunderstanding. If you're dealing with orcs with cultural differences from the culture that the PCs are more familiar with, all of this could be a misunderstanding. You know, it could be a choice of words. It could be etiquette. I love etiquette misunderstandings. Those are some of my favorites. when like I did the thing that I thought was the most respectful and you think that is the least respectful.
Oops.
Or I mean, actually, it's maybe even more fun to do it the other way around. I tried to offend you and I just keep ingratiating myself with you. And now I think I'm betrothed.
Unfortunate. Another weakness could be other orcs or, you know, their associated like hirelings or minions, right? An orc is only as good as its goblin frontline, if you will.
Yeah, and, you know, we haven't mentioned this yet, but it honestly should go without saying if you're dealing with sapient orcs with their own culture, is that they're not going to be monolithic. You could have many different cultures within, you know, orc society, many different societies within orcs on a planet or in a setting. And it may very well be that, you know, not all the orcs that you're fighting agree. So perhaps parlay... or perhaps just applying leverage in the right place to foment a coup would work very well.
All right, so let's talk a little bit about orc tactics.
Usually it's charge and get up close and personal. That's what the stat blocks in most games tend to lean toward.
Yeah, and I mean, this makes sense. They have a natural advantage in toughness. They want to use that advantage where it's most beneficial. That means getting in your face where you can't do the things you're good at.
Mm-hmm. So you're going to want to fight in numbers and then have them coordinate their movement and attacks. This might mean like using delayed actions or like know the mechanics of the system that you're running so that the orcs can work in tandem with each other as much as possible. Squads of orcs should have differentiated abilities like a party. So I wouldn't use four identical orc stat blocks if your party is facing four orcs. You know, think of it in terms of like party role and of abilities that can combo with one another.
Orcs are also probably going to rely on their toughness and hardiness and just tank most mundane attacks, right? Or they might use their numbers to, you know, ignore casualties, right? Like, you know, orcs live, they die, they live again. They aren't worried about, you know, one orc in the horde falling, right? Or one orc in the warband falling.
Right. And, you know, maybe that is because there is always another orc to take their place. Maybe it's because our healers are really good. And once we kill all of you, then we'll just get everyone back on their feet.
Right. Exactly. Nothing is really permanent.
Right. Orcs, we have death saving throws. What are you talking about?
Exactly.
stealth is usually... rare. I mean, it's not a common trope with orcs, but it can be an unexpected card that they have up their sleeve. You sort of get into this situation where, you know, oh, orcs are like the Tolkien kind of orc. Oh, they're, you know, stooped over and hunched and so sneaky. Oh, but they're not good at stealth. It was like, okay, well, which one is it? Honestly, right? Are they really good at fooling you? Or are they really bad at fooling you?
They have specialties. Like, there's no reason that, like, mm-hmm. you know, orc hunters aren't just as skilled at, you know, infiltration and sneaking about and sniping as any other hunter would be. Even if they can also, you know, pick up an axe that they've been training with and, you know, hit a lot harder with it than you can.
Yeah. Why have you never seen an orc rogue? Because they're the best.
Right. You know, In a lot of ways, you would probably expect orcs to use their environment more. A lot of times they seem to be more naturalistic in their approach to combat. So, you know, fighting in a forest or fighting in plains or fighting in mountains, like they're going to use the environment to whatever it is. They're probably less. I think there is a sense of some fantasy races that there's a right way to conduct warfare, right? Like, you know, you think of humans use like your traditional medieval tactics of archers and pikemen and cavalry, right? And like elves use forests and trees, and like orcs are like, well, since they're usually the aggressor in these stories, it seems like they're ready to fight just about anywhere.
I mean, I use traditional medieval tactics of not using archers because arrows cost money. I send in the Irish.
That's the other thing I was thinking of is like orcs could be like the Scottish Highlanders, you know, where it's like they're wearing kilts and carrying giant swords into the Napoleonic Wars. But I mean, God, you definitely want them going through the breach first, huh?
I mean, I've decided orcs now speak with a brogue. Sorry, dwarves. Again, if you look at the stat block, orcs are tough and like hand-to-hand combat, but that means that the first thing they're probably going to do is geek the mage, because that's going to be the biggest threat to them.
Yeah, exactly. Magic, scary. Not easily ignored by thick armor, thick skin, you know, like hard to ignore fireball. So let's make sure they don't use it.
You can also lean in on intimidation and fear. Maybe this isn't going to work on PCs because they naturally assume that they're going to win every combat, but it certainly can work on NPCs. You know, what are the peasants? What are the conscripts that the PCs are in charge of thinking when they face down a line of orcs who are now taunting them? And as we usually say here, the best tactics for a memorable, interesting fight that make for a good game might be different from the best tactics for the orcs themselves. So think about, what is the purpose of this battle? What are players supposed to get out of it? What are they supposed to feel about their interaction with the orcs? You know, I can always just throw 10,000 orcs at a party, and that might make sense within the fiction, but it's not going to make for a good game.
Right, and same thing with, like, you know, you can always count on orc reinforcements. Well, you know, if you're just going to TPK the party with infinite reinforcements, we could have saved ourselves the night and maybe just watched a movie.
Yeah.
All right, so let's talk about orcs as PCs.
So if you're an orc PC, think about how you interact with non-orcs. Is this a common occurrence for you? Is being in the party, presumably not entirely composed of orcs, a new and strange experience, a new and interesting experience that you've been very curious about? Or is this just par for the course? Yes, I know I'm in wizard school along with everyone else. And
then, of course, how do you interact with other members of the party? Like, how do your particular, you know, background and skills interact with what the rest of the party does?
Yeah, one of the nice things about being a PC is, of course, you are the exception that proves the rule, right? So maybe you are the toughest of your friends. Maybe you're not, though. And people might find that surprising if orcs typically are in your setting. What other qualities do you have that might get overlooked because you are an orc? And especially now, when you look at things like Cauldron of Everything has the options to let you switch around stats in 5th edition D&D. You can play like an actual orc with orc stats that doesn't necessarily have to have +2 strength, +1 constitution. It can be +2 intelligence, +2 charisma.
And then as an orc, you might also have to ask yourself, why aren't you traveling with other orcs, right? Like, if it's more common for orcs to stick together, why are you alone? Or if you are, you know, with a small group, why aren't you with a larger group?
You also might play in half orc. And if you are playing with people who've been playing fantasy games for a while, you're almost inevitably going to get the question about, like, your quote unquote problematic past. This is sort of up to you about, like, how you want to handle it. Like, I tend to err on the side of, like, what problematic past? Like, are you asking the half elf about their problematic past? Or, like, the human over there who has one human parent and another human parent?
Right.
Like, it doesn't have to factor into the story. It doesn't have to factor into your story as a half orc whatsoever. So feel free to completely discard it.
As a half orc, what is your legacy? What is the mark that you want to leave on the world? What is your goal? You know, are you leaning towards the type of legacy that humans usually want to leave? Are you leaning more towards the type of legacy that orcs type?
And what have you gotten from each parent? You know, physical characteristics, culture, motivations, magic items, fingers crossed, you know?
Right.
No. It's important to me. Both parts of my heritage are important, so I really need an heirloom item from each parent.
Exactly.
And then think about, what is it that you owe to orcs? Do orcs expect you to pledge fealty? Are you angry at orcs because you have been shunned and so you've sworn vengeance? You can also ask these questions about, you know, your human relations as well. But, you know, in the context of this particular episode, we're talking about orcs.
It's not that you owe them fealty. It's that you owe Grumsh fealty, and we're here to collect it. All right, so real quick, let's just run through magic and magic items for orcs.
They're usually made to kill orcs, at least the canonical ones.
Orc's Bane.
Yeah, although I love the idea of an orc who has one of those weapons that glows in the presence of orcs and just uses it as a light.
As a flashlight?
Right. Like, yeah, it always glows when I hold it. But if you think about it, low-level items in the hands of many orcs can be extraordinarily devastating. I mean, there's so much theory crafting about like, oh, if I had 1,000 archers and I gave them all plus one bow, think what I could do. Well, guess what?
Yeah.
And, you know, few people expect orcs with spell scrolls. Like, mix it up.
And then, as you've mentioned, like, a lot of times orcs have a theme of artifice. So, you know, even if they are just normal items or magic items, they might have a different sort of aesthetic or patina to them because they're from orcish origin, right? So you might flavor the magic item in a slightly different way.
All right. So in conclusion, orcs are everywhere. All the time in games, think about how you're using them, because so many people are just, well, using them as written, but often as written means like from this module from 1983.
Right.
And there's just so much more that you can do with them. And I just feel like there's like more that the tabletop community owes orcs, honestly, because I think they can be extraordinarily interesting and like empathetic characters in your game.
I totally agree. Orcs are one of my favorite like enemy groups in 5th edition. Like I like the way that they ladder up. You can keep facing orcs for several levels, mm-hmm. and like you can really build a theme around them, and you can really explore like that angle. Like I like them as warriors, right? Like I like confronting orcs as the army that you're dealing with, because they're competent, right? Because they win by default if you don't do something heroic to stop them. And like I think that's what makes them such a great enemy, is like they're going to win. Like they're the inevitable outcome if you don't do something heroic. All right, do you hear that, Ishan?
That is the sound of me doing something heroic, I guess, TBD.
All right, let's move on to the character creation forge, because shortly after doing something heroic, you do something tragic. Before we do that, let's talk about how our listeners can get in contact with us.
We do love hearing from you.
You can tweet at Shane at Mundangerous. That's M-U-N dangerous.
And you can tweet at Ishan at Evil Sense Carne. That's malice minus meat.
And you can tweet at the show at TPTcast.
You can also email us at TotalPartyThrill@gmail.com.
And you can find us on the web at www.TotalPartyThrill.com.
We're also on Facebook and Instagram at TotalPartyThrill.
And join the conversation on Discord. There's a link in the show notes. All right, so this week in the Character Creation Forge, we are building the All-Nighter. Ishan, what's the All-Nighter?
It's a character that records their podcasts back to back late at night so that they don't wake their babies. And so, you know, at 2 a.m, they're still doing it.
Yeah, I was going to say, I haven't done one of those since college, but it's really like I haven't done one of those since now.
Yep, right now. All right, no. So the All-Nighter, the biggest drawback to the Berserker Barbarian, which is such a cool subclass, but such an awful subclass, is that you quickly become useless due to stacked exhaustion penalties, and you can only recover from that with a long rest, and then only one level of exhaustion at a time. It's just garbage. So we're looking for ways to mitigate this to make Frenzy Barbarians interesting to play again.
All right, so how are we going to do it?
We're going to do Berserker Barbarian 9, Gloomstalker Ranger 11. We're going to slap on a great subclass.
All right, so obviously we're going to play an orc, and we're going to use the version from Eberron and Exandria, because that's the good version that doesn't have penalties.
Plus 2 strength, plus 1 con, dark vision, powerful build, 2 bonus skills, love that. And you can move closer to an enemy as a bonus action. Keep in mind, you just need to be closer to an enemy, not the enemy. So it's actually better the more enemies you have on the field, you would get extraordinarily mobile, because you can move in any direction. You just need to be closer to an enemy that you pick.
Ah, I see you've played tabletop 40K. I have to be closer, you say, but nothing says that I can't also move 9 inches around the backside of this unit.
All right, so we're going to kick it off with Barbarian 5. You get unarmored defense. Ultimately, you will end up with 4 rages per day, which I think most adventuring days are going to have about 4 encounters. I know the book says 6 to 8, but who does that? And like,
let's be honest here.
Don't play that game. And then you'll end up with a +3 damage bonus. You get Danger Sense, which will give you advantage on dexterity checks against effects that you can see. And you definitely want to be using Reckless Attack almost all of the time, which lets you roll with advantage basically all of the time. We'll take the optional feature to get an extra skill at level 3, because why the heck would you not? And then at level 3, you get your Frenzy. So you can, when you are raging, you can choose to go into a Frenzy. If you do, then you can make a bonus action attack while you are raging. But when your rage ends, you gain a level of exhaustion. And this suffers from the issue of any bonus action attack when you are a barbarian, in that you're using a bonus action on the first round of combat to go into your rage, and therefore you cannot do it in the first round of combat, and the average combat only lasts 3 rounds. It's also too onerous to use more than once, maximum 2 times per day, because then you've got these awful exhaustion penalties and you're just garbage at your main thing, which is attacking.
Right.
So that's fine. We can begin to mitigate this by using a double-bladed scimitar while we are not using our frenzy.
What book is that in?
it's in the Eberron book, Rising.
Okay.
Don't worry, it's a real thing. It costs 100 gold. It's expensive, but I mean, you know, just kill a Valinar elf and take it.
Okay.
So it's got a 2d4 damage die, which is smaller than your typical greatsword or your great axe. But as a bonus action, you can make a 1d4 attack with the butt end, and it doesn't have the drawbacks of dual wielding. You get to add your strength bonus to this. You also get to add your rage bonus. And if you do the math on it, it's almost always going to be better, especially with reckless attack, to be making 3 attacks as opposed to 2 attacks with a slightly bigger weapon. And then at level 5, you're going to get extra attack and fast movement, which applies to all movement speeds, which we'll get to later. Then you're going to want to take all 11 of your ranger levels. Multiclassing into ranger gives you an extra skill. This build ends up with lots of skills and lots of languages, and it's awesome.
You'll also get favorite enemy. Of course, you'll take 2 different races of humanoids so that you're ready to fight them. And you'll get another one at level 6.
And then we're going to swap out Natural Explorer for Deft Explorer, and at level 1 you get expertise in a skill and 2 more languages. It's amazing. You also get a fighting style at level 2. I like blind fighting here because we're going Gloomstalker, and there are a lot of situations where you're just going to be in the dark all the time. You can also take Druidic Warrior if you want for cantrips like Guidance. A lot of good Druid cantrips if that's the direction you want to go.
You'll get spellcasting up to 3rd level spells. You can't cast spells or concentrate them while raging, so you'll want to focus on utility and exploration spells, things like absorb elements, alarm, cure wounds, fog cloud, healing spirit, lesser restoration, pass without trace, revivify, you know, all the good ones to clean up the mess after combat or give you a warning before combat.
Yeah, or to position yourself really well, because Gloomstalker is such a good ambusher. Oh no, it's not nighttime. Okay, I fog cloud.
Oh, I rope trick.
Whoops. Gloomstalker does give you, because it's one of the good ranger subclasses, it gives you additional spells, including disguise self and rope trick. Again, utility. You know, if you are playing in a setting where orcs are discriminated against, don't look like an orc when you don't want to. And then the Primal Awareness optional feature gives you even more spells.
You'll also add your wisdom bonus to initiative. It, of course, is important to go early in the round because you don't get your full damage kicked in until round 2. So you want to make sure that you're part of the group that gets to act in that 3rd and potential 4th round.
Yeah. And, you know, it's great to be like the first or one of the first ones to go in round 2, because that still kind of feels like it's round 1, just like the end of round 1.
Right. Yeah. Just like in the NFL draft. Like, if you're the first guy in the 2nd round, it's basically the same as going in the 1st round.
Yeah.
You know, except for all the money.
In the first round of combat, you'll get an additional 10 feet to your movement speed. That stacks with fast movement, so you'll be extremely fast. And then you can make an extra attack as part of the attack action. This is going to offset the lack of your bonus action attack from your frenzy. So you're going to get three attacks in the first round, and then you'll be getting three attacks in subsequent rounds. And this attack adds an additional D8 damage. It'll bump up your dark vision to 90 feet, and you will be invisible to creatures who have dark vision. So if you're going to play around with this, then take blind fight.
At level 6, you'll gain a climb speed and a swim speed, so you can traverse any terrain.
Both of those, again, are increased by your fast movement and your extra 10 feet on your first round of combat. At 7, you get proficiency in wisdom saving throws, so you don't have to waste a feat slot on resilient. At level 8, people sleep on ignoring non-magical difficult terrain. I love it, and difficult terrain pops up from levels 1 to 20, where it's just like, here's some rubble, and there's no way to get around it, but if you're a ranger, you just walk through it, and then there are other scenarios where, like, you know, being stuck in water causes, like, it's difficult terrain because it's, like, hard to walk through it, and you're just like, nah, it's not there.
Right.
But really, we're here for level 10, finally. Tireless. You can get 1d8 plus wisdom mod temp HP, proficiency bonus times per day. Cool, cool. But also, on every short rest, you reduce your exhaustion by 1, which means now you can frenzy every single combat as long as you're going to get a short rest.
That's the sound of a build coming together.
Fine.
The rest is superfluous.
We just had to make the rest of the levels useful.
Right.
Then at this point, what you're doing is you've got 4 rages per day, right? You're going to frenzy every round during those. But if you end up running out of rages, or for some reason you don't frenzy, then you're going to want to switch back to your double-bladed scimitar to get that bonus action attack.
You'll also get Nature's Veil, which as a bonus action, you can become invisible until the start of your next turn. Proficiency bonus number of times per day.
And this is a way that you can mitigate that first round penalty where you can't use the frenzy, which is you can set up your combat. Like, you know, rage. It lasts for 10 rounds. You never need it for 10 rounds. So rage. And then turn invisible, position yourself properly, and then go all out. You just need to make sure that you're making attacks in there somewhere. Keep in mind, Nature's Veil does not go away like the invisibility spell when you attack.
Right.
And then at level 11, Stalker's Flurry means that once per turn, you'll be able to make an attack. You'll be able to attack again if you miss. And a nice thing about this is if you happen to be using the double-bladed scimitar and you miss with like the butt end, the 1d4 attack, that's fine. You can make an attack with the big end. Then we're going to finish up Barbarian to 9. At level 6, you're immune to Frighten and Charm effects while raging. At 7, you get advantage on initiative and can act normally in the surprise round, and you can move half your speed when you're entering the rage. And at 9, you get Brutal Critical, and you're going to be critting far more often because you get a bunch of attacks, and every single one of those is rolled with advantage.
Looks like we're going to be pretty tight on ASIs because we're going to need some dex, we're going to need some wisdom, we're going to need some strength. Mm-hmm. But if you can, you want to squeeze that Sentinel feat in there to get another big attack. All right, before we wrap up, we want to take a moment to thank our Patreon supporters.
Your support is what makes it possible for us to keep doing this show every single week. So if you'd like to learn more, you can check out all of our rewards at patreon.com/totalpartythrill.
You can also leave us a 5-star review on iTunes. It's the best way to help other people find the show and keep us growing. Ishan, do you want to read this week's?
This is More AP by Misty801 Factorial, I'm going to go with.
Okay.
Love the show. Intelligent, insightful conversation. But AP was the best. We need more Meepo, please. The people have spoken, Shane.
The people have spoken. Tez is the sidekick.
Misty, thank you for listening. Glad you liked it. We're gonna stat Tez up. It's going to be great.
All right. What do we have planned for next week's episode?
We are talking about reconnaissance.
And in the Character Creation Forge?
We're building radar.
Well, that's it for episode 286 of Total Party Thrill. I hope we lived up to our name, but either way, I'm Shane.
And I'm Ishan. Thanks for listening.